and welcome to another episode of the Scenic Route Podcast. This is actually take two. We tried doing this one yesterday and got a little combative with the internet over at the compound. So we are now being joined by Matt Mormon of Obsessed Garage. Welcome, Matt.
Hey, what's up, Adam?
And you can see that we are not in the same location. We're both extremely busy right now, and he lives pretty far away, but he tends to know a thing or two about video and audio equipment. So he's recording remotely, and I'm recording here. And then we're also looking at each other over a computer. Lots of tech.
Yeah, I got cameras here, camera there, mics here, mic here. And so I got mics all over the place.
Yeah, I got three mics in here too. I got one on the camera, I got one right here, and then I got one behind the camera too.
Dad jokes.
Probably would have taken less time if we just got in the car and met at Starbucks somewhere.
Yeah, you're not wrong. All right, so you have a little bit of preparation for my first question now, since I asked it to you yesterday and you already had to give me an answer. But I started this off with asking Matt to give me his elevator pitch if someone asked what he did. Kind of like me, does a bajillion different things, and it's hard for me to explain, so I was going to have him explain first. So, Matt, elevator pitch, go.
Yeah, it was way better than my probably spontaneous version of what I came up with. But my background's in wealth management and managing people's money, but I do now chase passion, where that was a job. Now this is where I chase passion all day. And so if someone were to, if I'm stuck in an elevator and ask me what I did, I would say I curate products from all over the world. So I search for products, search for things that I find interesting. And then I make videos about it, and I share my experience with things. And I have a tendency to obsess over those things and hopefully provide the world with value that otherwise doesn't exist without my neuroses. I have like real obsessive compulsive disorder, and that's what I think makes me at least halfway decent at searching for stuff. So all that being said, I'm basically a professional shopper. I shop for cool stuff all day. That's what I do.
That's a cool way to put it. I feel like the two things that stand out to me the most whenever I'm trying to like get the wow effect and I'm talking about you with someone, I'll mention the fact that you had like 15 different exhausts on your GT3 just to find out which one sounded the best. And I feel like that model is pretty much held constant for every product that you use. You get 15 different versions and try to figure out which one's actually legit. And you know, most people don't have the liberty to be able to do that, and you do it for them.
Yeah, most things I'll chase that hard, but the other part, that behind the scenes part that you don't see, is that because I do like things a bit too much, those 15 exhausts, there were probably 30 other ones that I'd weeded through that I didn't actually buy. So there's the research part, and then there's the purchase part. And then there's the willingness to, like, I took the car to the dyno 5 or 6 times to prove my case. And the reason I had to get 15 different exhausts from my original GT3 is there weren't any. Like, they didn't exist. So I was working with different companies to try to convince them what we wanted it to sound like. And now we have, so then I discovered Dundon, and then, your audience has seen you get different Dundon exhausts. But that got started from me finding somebody on the forum, and they were, like, my 13th exhaust. And so they ended up being the one after I tried a few more. But that is a microcosm of my existence of chaos and crazy that has become what has proven to be a pretty valuable business now because of this pursuit of things like 15 exhausts.
So is Obsessed Garage technically your first business that like is all your own?
Yeah, so I've progressed in the self-starting business side of things. So when I was younger, I was a janitor, and then I was worked for the post office for a little bit, and then I went to college and got an engineering diploma. And while in school, I was I learned how to sell. So I was selling electronics, and so you're commissioned. So I wasn't paid a salary; I got a commission. But people walk through the door, right? So I didn't have to find the customers. And then when I got a job in wealth management, the wealth management, like Merrill Lynch, had the platform. They had things to sell, but there weren't any customers walking through the door. And now Obsessed Garage is a business where there's no platform, there's no one walking through the door. And so, much like your business, you have to create it from scratch. And so, yeah, this is the first, like, on my own business But there's been a progression to make it there, and that's been the sort of taking the easy route of non-salaried positions that then turned into a, you know, a, like a true business that I own myself.
So your first business, how many years has it been now?
I guess I technically applied for the LLC in 2016. I say I started the retail side of the business, the selling online, in 2017. So January like 25th or something like that is when I turned my first product on. Before that, I was just like, before I met you, I didn't even monetize a YouTube channel, right? It was just, I'm just making videos just for the fun of it because it's an outlet, a therapeutic outlet. And when I met you, you're like, you need to turn the YouTube revenue. You need to turn on the monetization, which didn't make me much. But but I had such a bought-in audience that as soon as I turned the products on, they instantly took off.
Yeah, you know, I want to touch on our first little meetup a little bit deeper, but I'm trying to establish the scope of Obsessed Garage. So if you don't mind sharing, how many employees are you at right now?
I just hired one today. I think we're at 32 now. So 32 people.
I think that's when you max out an iPhone group chat. I don't know if you have an Obsessed Garage iPhone group chat, but I think at 30, we just maxed out at the LZ compound. And I think it was 32, and then you can't add anyone else.
Yeah, so we have 30 people, and I'll probably double that in the next 12 months or so. I'm chasing a lot of new products and a lot of new ideas, and doing things like I'm going to buy a bunch of properties across the U.S. and outfit them and all the cool stuff that I sell, and allow people to borrow those for money from me and do stuff like that. So we're going to have a lot more employees here in the not too distant future.
So, yeah, you know, out of anyone that I know, you're probably more transparent with numbers, financials, like even down to doing a car giveaway. Matt has literally told people what he's made off of a giveaway.
They still don't believe me though sometimes. It's crazy.
I was just going to say, if you're comfortable to give a little bit of scope of Obsessed Garage, like rough ballpark sales numbers, if you don't want to say it, no problem whatsoever.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Money, just let me preface it by saying this. You know, money is a result. Right, and so it's a result of a lot of effort, a lot of knowledge pursuit. It really doesn't mean much, but it does add context. And so, like for instance, when I do a giveaway, if it's appropriate, I'll share the profitability so that people, because I believe that when people are supporting you, it's not that they're owed the numbers; they're owed, I think, some transparency. And a lot of times now, I don't share the numbers as much because of the scale of them, just because people don't have a reference for it. So we sell generally, you know, somewhere on the order of 1.6 to 2.2 million a month, and so we'll probably do a little over 20 million in revenue this year. I'm not sure, 100% sure what my pre-tax margins are. I still, to date, even though, so just do the math. If I'm selling $20 million worth of stuff and I have a 35% average margin, and yet I still haven't really gotten a paycheck yet, so all the money just keeps going back in. You can relate to this more than anybody, and that you reinvest back in, probably unintelligently. I should probably extract some of the profitability out, but I just get another idea. There's another product, another cool thing. Like right now, I'm jerking around with closet organization. And I'm like, well, how can I teach the world how to make their closets better? And that's my curse, but also the thing that motivates the heck out of me. So yeah, so we have 30 people. We're doing it in like 7,000 square feet. So we don't have a lot of space. So we're turning inventory. It's really pretty remarkable to see the stuff that goes out the door. Of these really elaborate like pressure washers and flooring and now audio systems for the garage and detailing supplies and, you know, all the different things I've curated from all over the world. And just to give people an example, I sell one soap, not 10 soaps, not 12 car soaps. There's only one that I like, and so why would I sell 10? And so I curate the products and make a very specific choice, and I think that's what people value from me is that choice of, I'm not trying to capture a sale, I'm just providing people the same thing that I want. And so that's what I've been, so focused on. I think I think it's a, you know, I think it's a $500 million business, and we'll see where it goes. You know, so 4 years in, we're doing, you know, 24 million, something like that. It's pretty remarkable.
I know, and you know, like you said, the money is a result, right? But for me, you know, I'm thinking about myself listening to this podcast. If I were listening to it and not doing what I'm doing right now and didn't know you, hearing that someone that never had their own business started a business 4 years later is doing numbers like that, like, that would motivate me. Yeah, it's a result, but knowing, like, man, it's just crazy. But
and that's why I share it a lot. That was my choice in the beginning, was that, you know, I didn't start making videos for money. I didn't start for anything other than just, because the obsessive compulsive thing is not like a marketing thing. It's like, the part of the reason why I'm not there doing this with you is I can't drive. You know, and at times I'm unable to get in a car, and I have 7 cars and I can't freaking drive any of them. So the curse is real, and the curse of obsessive compulsive disorder is part of what makes the business tick. But it's a real issue. And so when I share things like that, or I share things like numbers, it's very different than how other people do it. But I think it's what connects me to the audience. I mean, you've seen the people that, you know, like Obsessed Garage people that follow me, that they, you know, you have this too, where you have people that they really know you, they get you, they understand you. And being this style of transparent, it really does help, I think, create a bought-in business, a bought-in relationship rather than just a transaction.
No, I agree. I think, you know, having that transparency adds a lot of legitimacy and makes you stand out from all the other nameless, faceless companies, if you will. Can you go a little bit deeper on the whole not driving thing? Because I understand it, but when I tell people you don't drive, they like stop dead in their tracks and they're like, what?
So the root of my issue is worry and obsession over something called vasovagal syncope. When I was younger, and I think I was in sixth grade, was the first time it happened, where I was visiting my grandmother in the hospital, and she had just a knee replacement, and she about to puke into the little puke tray, and like, I'm like, what is going on? I got to get out of here. And so I literally started dead sprinting as I'm blacking out. And so I have, some people have this where it's a fight or flight mechanism where my body, you know, naturally sort of, so the neurons fire, all the blood leaves all of your extremities and goes to protect the heart, and you pass out. And it was always a joke. It's just this kind of goof joke. Like, I've always been big and strong and used to be fit before they put me on all these medication. And I would, I'd go to get my teeth pulled or something, I'd pass out. And you know, in the doctor's office, I'd pass out, but never anywhere else. And so the reason Obsessed Garage got started is in 2014, we had my first child, or second child. I passed out in the delivery room. And then later that week, I was in a store and I was just kind of scrolling through Facebook. And one of my buddies had like some sort of stomach surgery or something like that, and the Black Death came over me. I didn't pass out in the store, but I almost did. But I never had any angst about it. I would just go to the doctor's office and it would hit me like subconsciously. Well, at that moment, so this was August like 25th of 2014, I remember the day specifically, and I had like an introduction to anxiety at that point. So what passing out is just like your body flighting or leaving the like ultimate anxiety, you know, episode. And so I just disappear, just pass out, just hit the ground. And so it was at that moment that I recognized that, oh my gosh, this could happen anywhere else, not just in a doctor's office. And so I had to get in the car, and I didn't know what was happening to me, but I had to get in the car and drive back to meet my wife wherever we were. And I felt like I was going to pass out while driving down the road. And so that episode sort of opened up or introduced this possibility that I could be driving, you know, down the road and pass out. And so I have this like obsession, just pure, you know, overthought of this possibility that I could be driving down the road and could pass out. It's never happened and really shouldn't happen. But I've had many, many like these like total irrational panic attacks. The weirdest part about it is it's worse if I'm at a stoplight. So if I'm stopped, I'm not going anywhere. Like, nothing can happen.
I guess it's a good thing, though, if it happens there.
Yeah, but it sucks, so I can't go anywhere. And so what I've done the last 6 or 7 years is I've had these kind of ebbs and flows of being able to drive. Like, you know, I've driven with you. We went to the mountains, no problems. I've had these periods where I struggle with it, and then I just power through it. I just white-knuckle it and just freak out. So I'm driving down the road, panic. I'm driving down the road fine, and then in an instant, panicked. And so the what I'm attempting to do now is to, like, slowly... When I say I can't drive, I'm doing a very controlled, specific, or attempting to get me to drive, me and my therapist, without me just powering through. Because one time powering through, I'm going to end up passing out and driving over a brick wall somewhere. So that's the curse that I have, is this issue. And so that's where it manifests in driving more than anything. That's like the one thing left. You know, that, and if I go to the dentist, I freak out a bit. But so there's this, it's an anxiety disorder induced by just obsessing over the future of my, you know, fear of something medically related. It's a bunch of frickin' nonsense. And it's, imagine how frustrating it is that I'm basically a mathematician, right? I'm an engineer. I'm a, you know, extremely rational person. And I'm sitting in a stoplight, panicked, for no reason, and I can't reason out of it. So that's the curse. That's the frustration. And so, but it's also what makes me great. It's why I bought 15 exhausts. You know, it's why I can't shut it off. So, but sharing the story is what's made, because otherwise I'm just an arrogant prick talking about money all the time, you know?
Yeah.
So to me, sharing the struggle is the humanization of what otherwise could be misconstrued as a jerk.
Yeah, I think it's important. You know, we all have issues, we all have flaws, and, you know, people relate and I feel like bond more to negative stuff than positive things. You know, going through hard times with someone or being able to relate to something that you go through, you form a much stronger relationship with that person. And whether it's someone in real life or on the internet, it makes a difference for sure.
Yeah, and I think that you can see this with you, and it's funny, I won't mention any names, but while I was waiting to kind of set up here, I just clicked on a suggested YouTube video, and it's one of the other car people, and it's just pure fake. You know, you can sniff out authenticity, and they're just doing it just to get the views, just to get the praise.
Well, they got your click, so. Right. You gave him the click.
that's what that guy is thinking, you know, whatever, I got the click, you know, whereas, you know, you get a lot of clicks, you get a large audience, but part of the thing where I think I can really relate to you and why I think we're such good friends is you're authentic. You know, in the video that made me originally reach out to you was one of the first videos I ever saw. I had no interest in BMX, but you were talking about why you weren't dropping out of college, why you were going to finish the degree. And that authenticity, I think people can sniff out, you know, they can see it. And the weird ones, the ones that can't, that don't even recognize it, are the ones that, you know, you wish would go away, and they usually do pretty quickly. But then the people that are bought into what you're doing can create a reason for you to exist, and a business can be born out of it.
I mean, here's the thing, they got your click, but you're never going to watch one of their videos again.
Yeah.
And right. I think that's something that people got to keep in mind, whether you have a business or a video or whatever you're doing. Like, just because you get someone in the door doesn't mean anything. You're better off having one customer that's with you for a lifetime than 10 people walking through the door that will never come back.
And that's been my, you know, we learned this early on when I first met you, and I got a bunch of, you know, you were what, 20 or something like that at the time. And, you know, your average age audience was 14. And next thing you know, I got all these subscribers of all these people that really didn't belong. They were just there because you asked them to be there. And I learned early on in the very beginning, I'm just going to keep doing me, and I'm not going to... Like, I'd probably be better off shutting up and going doing donuts in my GT3. You know, it'd probably be a smarter move. But then what do I gain from that other than some short-term, you know, ad revenue from Google? I'd rather build a long-standing business and ability to hire people that I really enjoy being around, and then have the ability for them to provide leverage and rocket fuel around doing more things that I like to do, like shopping for speakers, you know, or, you know, ordering weird lights for the garage. You know, that's the stuff that I want to do.
I think just being you, and, you know, people focus sometimes on trying to do what people want and give the people what they want and cater their content or their products around that, when the easiest person to appeal to is yourself. And it's a huge world out there, and there might be 10 people like you out there, there might be 1,000, there might be 10,000, but if you can make a product that those 10,000 people are going to obsess over, you're better off than making one that a million people feel okay about.
I think so. I think if you choose the latter, if you chase the numbers, you end up with a job. Mm-hmm. Even though you work for yourself, if you chase that, like we're talking about the video I was watching before, that guy has a job. He's stuck. He's beholden to that. You know, in the detailing world, a lot of these guys are doing like these disaster details where they're cleaning up like puke off of minivans. Like, they get huge views and they're making lots of money, but that's a job. Like, why would you, you know, I don't know this, but I would guess that the person doing that doesn't really want to clean up puke off of a, you know, family minivan.
I mean, it's probably satisfying the first time, but I wouldn't want to do that more than once.
Yeah, and so there's that delicate balance that even if you do have success in getting numbers and engaging people, it becomes a really horrible way to live. And it would be worse, I think, than being something, you know, working some, you know, 9-to-5 that you really hate.
No, I definitely agree with that. So let's rewind. You saw this video of mine. You said it was a video talking about not dropping out. I know obviously my half of the story after we met up, but prior to meeting up, what was going through your head before you sent me an email?
So I was at Merrill Lynch. I was a, you know, senior vice president, and I was also a senior resident director. So I managed my office, and I was always looking for young, talented people to come and work either for me or, you know, for the company. Because I thought being a financial advisor was the best job in the world, because you can make lots of money. It was really hard to do. I thought I was passionate about it, just because I didn't think I could do anything, you know, hobbies. I didn't think you could take a hobby and make money off of it like I could doing chasing this career. And so I just shot an email to you, and I had no idea, you know, how much you were making from, you know, from views, from ad revenue and sponsors and things like that. But I'm like, man, if someone can engage, and you probably had what, 500,000 or 600,000 subscribers or something at the time. And I was like, man, if someone like this could enroll this many people, imagine, you know, when he graduates, he's getting a business degree. Let me just shoot him an email and maybe we can go to lunch and I can convince him to come work with me. And then I'd take him under my wing and I could, you know, teach him how to manage people's money. And then you could use that, you know, that ability to influence and engage with people to then build a business around it. And so I sent you an email that we went to Four Rivers Barbecue. I brought my blue GT3. And
well, I mean, that's key to the story, right? Because I'm lying. I get a million emails every day or whatever. And this dude's emailing me. The only reason I give him any time of day is because he like slips in there casually like, oh, and I have a GT3 if you want to go for a ride. And that had been my dream car. I don't even know if I've ever been up close to one in person. And
But you had to have at least Google searched, right? Did you at least?
I don't think I did.
No.
I literally think you were just some random dude that messaged me and was like, oh, financial, that sounds fancy. Oh, he has a GT3? All right. Like, even now, like, I don't think I've ever done that in my life. I just went out to lunch with some random dude from the internet.
Yeah. I've never sent anybody an email, ever.
Yeah.
You know, and like I've never like reached out to some other YouTube kid, you know, to go and go to lunch with. It wasn't one of those things. And you know, you taught me so much like that day about what it meant to be, you know, like just information on simple things like analytics and when to release a video and what, you know, what videos could do. And I think we talked quite a bit about some of the channels you had gotten shut down because you guys figured out how to game the system of, you know, mm-hmm. you know, having your friends just click on videos to get, you know, more ad revenue and do things like that. And I think this was like your fourth or fifth channel or something like that. And I just was super, I was just enthralled. I was just like, what? I didn't even know this was a thing. You know, so this was what, 2015. So This was, you know, this was shoot six, seven years ago now. Feels like a lifetime ago. But that's when we came up with this idea of, why don't you guys should come up, let's make some videos of driving the cars. And then we went to the mountains for sure, maybe a month or something like after that. And I let you
just tosses the keys to his GT3 right. to some 20-year-old kid he barely knew.
Well, I figured if you can go sideways, that, you know, you can correct it. That's the way I thought of it. And
I barely knew how to drift back then too. So it's not even like I was like a good driver, but I felt like I did decent.
Until you got owned by that girl in a Jetta. Remember that?
We don't talk about that.
So now we're on the Dragon, right? And I go down the Dragon, and then we come back up the Dragon. And so I toss the keys to Adam, so he's driving. And we're behind it was like a rental VW Jetta, like a stock, probably was a 7 or 8 year old Jetta. And we're in my blue GT3, lowered, modified, exhaust, the whole thing. You know, PDKS, and Adam's getting owned by he can't quite keep up with this girl in a stock. We didn't know it was a girl at the time, but turns out it was like a motorcycle racer, like a crotch rocket racer girl that lives there, and she like basically lives on the Dragon, knows every turn, every square inch of it, but we couldn't keep up with it. And then, you know, we launched the video, and then next that girl commented on it, said, yeah, that was me. And so we thought it was some like race car driver, but it was some like, you know, 19-year-old girl who owned Adam on the Dragon in a GT3. So those were the days.
Now everyone knows. They'll never let me live it down.
Yeah. So that's the story. You did drive my car though that night. Oh no, wait. Did you drive? You didn't drive it on Four Track. Rivers. No, Four Rivers.
No, I didn't. Yeah, but you gave me a ride in it. You ripped some gears. I remember. Hit all the 9,000 RPMs for me.
Yeah, it changed your life.
It did. All jokes aside, I think more so than giving me the ride in the GT3, but bringing me on that Smokies trip and me realizing how down to earth all the GT3 guys were and like realizing how cool the community was really pushed me to say like, all right, I'm going to do this. Like, I'm going to find my way to get a GT3 RS, and I'm going to go and I'm going to show up with my own car. All these guys that I'm talking to probably think that I'm crazy saying that I'm going to be at the next one with my own GT3. And, you know, maybe it was 3 or 4 later, but for me, that was such a huge goal to just have myself laser focused on getting. Like, again, yeah, it's financial and it's the result. But for me, like, I find myself getting complacent if I don't have something that I'm really striving for. And it pushed me to go that extra mile and, you know, stay up till midnight instead of going to bed at 10 or whatever.
And it's cool to see, like, when we went to those events, it was probably my fourth or fifth one that I've been to with those guys. I mean, they are all passionate. I mean, some of these guys are worth, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, they've had successes, they've built businesses, sold businesses, had great careers, or have a great career. And I think pretty much every car community, no matter how much, you know, money the car costs, whether it's Ferrari or McLaren or Porsche, or, you know, I think Porsche is a pretty special community. But these are people that are just passionate about what, you know, about a specific car. And there's no, you know, when you go up to a place like the Carolina Mountains, I think your ego gets left in Atlanta or wherever city you came through. And it can be a magical experience. And I think most people that go up to the mountains and have an experience like that, it can really change your perspective on you're pursuing something that's material that most would view as nonsense. But when you're engaged with a bunch of other people that think in a similar fashion, it frees you up the ability to drop all that baggage of, oh, this is just some material object. Because I know that you are very worried about what's, you know, what is my, what are people going to think about, how are people going to take this, you know, this $300,000 or $200,000 car that I'm buying. You know, this is for me. I want to share it with people, but, you know, not everybody is equipped to handle that, you know, and perceive that the way it's really meant. And so when you get with a group of people that understand it, it really is awesome to experience that.
I feel like you can almost explain it to someone that would make more sense as like, you know, boats. Boats aren't cheap, right? But maybe it's your dream to be out on the water and to live the boat life. And if you go and get a boat, people don't think about it as ridiculous as going and getting an exotic car. And I know people spend damn near close to as much as we do on our cars on boats.
Oh, way and more. Although
it may just seem like a possession, it's like kind of the gateway into that little society, that little community, that world with other like-minded individuals. And not to mention, it's pretty cool. Like when I went up there, not only was I surprised by how down to earth everyone was, but the fact that every single dude, like, I don't know, what did you say the average age is, like mid 40s up there?
I'd say mid 50s.
Maybe a little younger?
Yeah, mid 50s.
Mid 50s. And they're driving their cars way harder than I would have, being like an early 20 year old up there. I'm like, these dudes are crazy. They're out of their mind. They're having a blast. They're safe. Like, they're not reckless, but they're enjoying the cars. They're not letting them sit in a garage. And that is the type of community that I wanted to belong to. I wanted a driver car. That's why I wanted a GT3. You know, it's just cool that all these people that have them think and feel the same way.
Yeah, most of those guys have, you know, 20, 30 years of track experience, you know. And most Porsche guys spend a lot of time on their driving skill. And you can, you know, you can see that, and it's awesome to go up there with somebody like that because they know the roads, they know how to, you know, how to handle the car, and they can kind of make it more fun for you because they lead, and you just, it's a lot easier to follow than it is to lead, you know, when you don't know where you're going. It's really one of the things that's helped me out a lot when I've had difficulty driving. I can go up there and kind of re-acclimate and just sort of cleanse myself of the you know, driving around in bumper to bumper traffic, and it's helped me out. So I'm actually going up in May, hoping to be able to get back on the road again.
That'll be cool.
Yeah.
So, all right, we have our little meeting at Four Rivers, and you know, one thing that I find interesting is in both of the things that we were doing, we kind of both had the same idea and mentality of why we were successful, and it's very relationship based, right? What you were doing was very relationship based, cultivating these relationships and retaining clients. I'm doing the same thing, but with social media, with YouTube, getting views. And you know, Matt and I are part of a business coaching group, and we were talking through something with someone on there, and I thought it was interesting. I was explaining to someone, I think it was in real estate or someone with clients, how important it is to just retain that relationship. And I really think in every area of business, whether it's social media, non-social media, that whole relatability, relationship-based thing is the center, the forefront of being successful.
Yeah, so the concept that, you know, Rick talks about is that if you, so Rick is our coach, what I have had for many years, and it's been a large contributor to my personal success, because relationship is one of those things that's not innate with me. I'm very good with inanimate objects. I'm very good with things and numbers, but not so much people. And believe it or not, you know, Adam is an introvert as well. And so I think we can relate on this, that like managing employees as well as managing, you know, relationships with people that are, you know, all aspects of your life, friends, also, you know, customers, clients, things like that are difficult to deal with. But what Rick talks about, and this really hit home with me, is that if you take any corporation, just say they're in one giant skyscraper, and they have desks and phones and computers and assembly lines and all kinds of different things. And without the humans, there's no business, right? Without the relationship of one department with another or one person with another, there's nothing. There's just a building with stuff in it. And so that relationship is the key to anything. And so business is really an excuse to be in relationships. And so I really take that to heart, and that's part of why I think my brand or my way to do it is to be authentic and transparent. And that is my way of developing a relationship by allowing people in on who it is I am and what I am, what I'm about. And sometimes what I'm about is chasing some really expensive car that has no real purpose in life other than it's just really interesting to me. And when I let go of that, and that's what started YouTube for me, is I stopped listening to everybody telling me that you should not share your successes. And I just said, you know what? I believed that if I shared it in an authentic way and shared the passion behind it, that I wouldn't lose all the relationships that I've always been taught I would be. I would lose if I'd been too transparent. You know what I'm saying? That keeping it all to yourself thing. Because I think people know who you are. Right? They know who you are. You can lie all you want, but people can kind of smell it on you. They can kind of sense it. So why not just be, like, I was wearing a suit every day. Like, what is this pretending to be rich? I'm from the frickin' trailer park. Like, why am I pretending? This isn't me. I even hired like a style consultant to like put on some fake version. And so that's not a real relationship. It's just a transaction. And so I, you know, when I let that all go, my life changed and exploded into this whatever it is now, where I just get to do whatever it is I want to do every second of the day.
So after our meeting where you tried to convince me to be a financial advisor and I inadvertently convinced you to do more on YouTube, what do you think was the first step or the pivotal moment that set you on the trajectory of where you are now?
Well, it was probably your garage. You know, I had already started the down the path of selling some products, but I thought that so I started the YouTube channel and it was more therapy, just me sharing my cars. And then some guy on a forum said you should make a video. So on the forum, I was taking photos and writing articles as my form of therapy right after this episode in 2014. That's when I started the 15 exhaust and sharing my discovery and all that. And so I made a YouTube channel just to show people how to wash a car. And I didn't realize that, you know, not very, very few people know how to do that. I just thought everybody knew what I knew. And no, people don't know squat. And so I learned how little people know. And then I learned how much value there could be in sharing what it is I know, both for me and for them. So there was an equal exchange there. And then I figured out that, you know, maybe there could be like a side hustle in this. And so after, you know, going to lunch with you, it really solidified for me that this is a way for me to get clients in wealth management, right? So this is a way for me I'll build a garage with Adam. They'll, people will see how smart I am, and they'll look up who I am in wealth management, and they'll hire me to manage their money. And then maybe maybe I can get some free stuff. Maybe I can get some free cabinets, and maybe we can get some sponsors and things like that. And maybe I could, you know, maybe I could get something out of this. But I thought it was a way for me to connect with clients, to find clients, because I had managed retirees' money. I had nothing in common with any of these people. And so I thought this could be an avenue for me to build a company called Obsessed Wealth Management, and I could then get managed car guys' money instead of old people's money that I had nothing in common with. And it, I thought, could be a real quick and easy way for me to just not have to cold call and do the things that I didn't want to do. So we built your garage, and the hope was that we could get some cool stuff, right? And it'd be fun. And I came down every day for like, what was it, like a month or something like that, or 2 or 3 weeks. And we did the cabinets, we did the flooring, we did lighting, we did all that stuff. And I think we did pretty much everything ourselves. We had Kalos come and help us do the lift, but you and I did everything. And we videoed it and shared it. And I think it was sometime around then I realized that the real business for me wasn't to get clients in wealth management. It was to build garages, you know, and to provide a solution from start to finish, not just sell a product here and there, but to be able to provide a whole, you know, the light switch, the paint, the every part and piece. Like, we painted your garage a specific color. It's called Harbor Gray. Everybody always asks what color. We did a whole, you know, I think we built the business right then and there, putting it in your garage. So we basically made your garage look just like mine.
Yep.
And that style is kind of the style. You know, it's a sterile, clean, organized style. And you let me do whatever the heck I wanted with I let you have zero input.
What I thought was cool about that, now looking back, is we were the perfect storm, right? You had this younger kid with maybe not a ton of like credibility in that world with a lot of followers, right? Like we had the numbers, and then you had kind of the credibility, the legitimacy, the professionalism. So I feel like we were able to leverage like that quite a bit in being able to work with companies at the time where, like, had I hit Swiss Tracks up for flooring, it probably would have been a lot harder if I was just like, hey, I make BMX videos and I have a home, I want to put your floor in my garage. But like, you created the package and the value, and I just had the numbers at the time. Well, but it was cool.
Because what happens for guys like you is you get where the dollars are available for products. Meaning you get products that aren't great. You get
high margin products.
Yeah, high margin, highly marketed products, right? And so what I'm interested in are the same things they're putting in a dealership. You know, I'm interested in like professional grade stuff. Those idiots don't know how to market at all, right? So it's generally the people that are great at marketing don't make great products. The people that don't know how to market make the good products. And so what you see, you know, advertisements for on a lot of things, especially if you're younger, is you're getting, you know, venture capital money spent on, you know, products that are then, you know, that money's distributed out to get people to talk about it, to try to make a name for the product. Whereas I was more interested in, like, what is a dealership, what is Porsche going to put inside of their dealership? I want that in my garage. Well, if you try to approach them to get them to, you know, be involved in some 20-year-old kid's project, they're going to tell you to get lost. And so I was able to bring that because I had been, you know, promoting their products prior to a small audience, and we went over to bring them the numbers, and so then they, you know, afforded us the ability to do it.
I don't want to say that, like, prior to that I bought junk, because I feel like I think I owned a set of BBS LMs before I met you. I think that was probably my first, like, name brand part or thing that I ever bought in the world of homes or cars. But apart from that, like, I was never, I don't want to say elitist because has a negative connotation, but you basically exposed me to buying nice things. Prior to you, I was content with, like, IKEA everything. I had no idea of the value of a nicer product, and I feel like you kind of ruined me to a certain extent. To where now I like, my brain always goes for the nicer end things. Do you kind of know what I'm getting at?
Well, I introduced you to swirl marks. I think that's the biggest, best example.
God, right? The worst thing you could ever do to anyone is show them what a swirl mark is. It'll ruin their life.
So, and I showed you what it looked like when they weren't there. And so that's a microcosm of life, right? And so you have the same, you know, you have to draw the line somewhere. Right, so like there's a lot of things I don't spend money on, but if I have a choice, I want to pursue something where somebody else was passionate about producing that thing. You know, so if it's a knife that I'm going to use to cut my steak, I'm interested in buying a knife from somebody who's passionate about knives. And chances are that means that it's going to cost more than buying something from Bed Bath & Beyond. You know, and I feel like it's lazy to just buy stuff at Home Depot and IKEA and Bed Bath & Beyond. That's back to the highly marketed thing. They're marketed better.
But I think, you know, let's just say we buy bougier things, right? I don't think we're buying name brand things that are taxed because they have a crazy name brand. I feel like, yeah, we may be paying double the price of an inferior product, but I feel like the quality, it goes up in scale with the price. So like as an example, a GT3, you know, if you pay sticker price for a new GT3, I think it's worth every penny. I don't think you're paying a premium because it's some Porsche GT3 name. I think the development, the engineering, the quality of the things used on it is worth every single penny.
But you could buy a Camaro ZL1 for half the price and go faster, you know. So one can argue, and usually you'd only argue that if you didn't have the money to buy the GT3. But there are diminishing returns as you approach perfection, you know, as you approach. So some of the things that, you know, Porsche does that makes it better overall, are, you know, there's an exponential cost of that rather than just a 1x or 1.5 times or 2 times cost. So there's to pursue perfection, and you could chase it, like watches would be a good example. I mean, you could spend an infinite amount of money on watches. I have an Omega. So watches aren't really my thing, but I have a nice Omega Seamaster that I rarely wear. But you could buy I don't even know names of, you know, some of these really expensive, you know, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 watches. You could chase, you know, prestige. And I think that if I was into watches, I would probably be chasing after, you know, something really expensive. So you have to draw the line somewhere. But I'm not wearing, a Casio. If I'm gonna wear a watch, I'm gonna at least wear something nice, and that I've at least done some vetting on, that there's a reasoning behind me wanting to chase that thing. And it's not about what anybody else thinks. I don't give a crap what anybody thinks about my watch or my hat or my car. It's about what is really interesting to me.
One thing that I think is kind of nice, I feel like with most of the more expensive things, when you're paying for quality, they tend to hold their value better too. You know, if you're buying something on the higher end, and I mean, maybe I'm just thinking cars, but like, you know what I'm saying? If you buy something where the quality matches the price, like wheels are a great example. I'd argue this when I got my BBS LMs, that someone buying replica LMs, if they buy them new and then sell them used, they're going to lose more money than me buying new authentic BBS LMs.
Generally, yeah. Selling them. Yep. And they'll probably get bent, and they're likely to chip and flake, and you know, and have problems. And I think that you can make a choice in life. You can make a choice to accept that. There's a time and a place for a replica. You know, there's the argument. I'd always taken the path of, I'd rather just wait and not get it than to buy a rep or to buy something inferior. For instance, I didn't buy my first pressure washer was a Krenzla, a $1,200 pressure washer. But I didn't get it till I was 33 or 34 years old, or something like that. I wanted a pressure washer a long time ago, but I didn't get one until then. And then, but some people would, and I do this now, I've realized this, I sell Karcher pressure washers that are $130. Because I've realized that there are progressive steps in life. And some people, you know, like maybe people are like me with a watch, and that they may not value, you know, that expense. They may not have infinite. Most people don't have infinite resources, and so they may not value it. And so they, even if they had that money, they may want to allocate those funds to something they really do love and enjoy. And so same thing can happen with cars and wheels and things like that. I'd always taken the path of just forego and wait, and then do something better. Yeah.
No, I can resonate with that, because I know that I've searched for that instant gratification in the past, and I think it was prior to the world of cars, and got something quick because I wanted gratification that wasn't what I really wanted, and then you have post-purchase remorse, and then you're kind of just regretting that decision and wishing that you got the right thing, and you don't end up getting the right thing because you punish yourself for making the wrong decision. And
It's really
satisfying when you wait for the right thing.
Right, I've never done that. My whole life, I've just never done that.
Yeah.
I've always... Now, I bought things that didn't work out. You know, I thought I was going to be a cyclist. You know, Mm-hmm. I bought it was $10,000. You know, I didn't have $10,000, but I bought a $10,000 carbon fiber bicycle, and I'm, you know, 6'2", 240, and I'm trying to race with, like, you know, guys that are, you know, 5'7", 130, and we're trying to hill climb together, and realized that that wasn't a good move. But I don't think I've ever just, I couldn't tell you a time where I'd just buy something just to buy it. I just can't relate to that. You know, people like go to they go car shopping like on a weekend, and they come home with a Buick or a Camry or something, right? You know what I'm saying? Like, how can, I can't even imagine that. Like, because I enjoy the process so much of pursuing and chasing and figuring out and doing the research and watching videos and doing things like that. I just can't imagine people that just go car shopping on a weekend and they come home with some, you know, Jeep Grand Cherokee or something like that. It's nuts.
That was my first car. I didn't know any better, and I was at a dealer. I wanted a Jetta GLI, and I got wooed and salesmaned into a automatic 325i because it looked low and had cool window tint on it. And from that, my biggest advice to people always, they ask me, what should I get for my first car, is I just tell them, you don't know what you want for your first car. You have no clue, and you're going to think you know what you want. You're going to get it, and then you're going to realize you didn't get what you want. So just get something cheap to get from point A to point B, because your friends are going to have cool cars. You're going to get to drive other people's cars. Then you're going to find out what you really want, because it's a huge decision, and you're probably going to crash your first car, whether it's on purpose or by accident.
See, I can't relate to any of that. Whatever you're saying there, I can't relate to any of it. When I was a kid, I was, you know, 14 years old, I wanted a Ford Probe GT, and there was no compromise. That's what I never got it. But because I got stuck with my dad, picked it. You know, but I knew exactly what I wanted, and I never crashed a single car ever in my life. So you keep going with that, but I'll let you have it. But you're right. This is my curse. This is why I can't drive down the road. Some freaking
cycle. To be fair, my crashes were me trying to drift in snow. So, like, foreshadowing, I guess. All right. Well, I feel like there's 7 million different paths we can go down with this. And to be completely transparent, my dad's in town. It's the last day that he'll be here, and I want to make sure I'm not too late to dinner with him. So before, I think we're going to need to do another podcast, because there's a lot of paths I want to go down. But I guess what I want to kind of end with is, what do you think has been the biggest challenge from starting Obsessed Garage, you know, rewind back in time, us sitting down, whatever, to now? What is the biggest hurdle that you think you could share, that we could kind of dive into, that people could get something out of?
My biggest challenge is and always will be people.
Same.
And I have no problem enrolling and finding people. When I have a problem, my biggest challenge is acknowledging those people for what it is they're good at, what it is they provide value. For example, I'd realized here recently that one of the things I was doing is that I had crafted, you know, all of my people that work for me, I in my head crafted their future, where I'm going to take them. Notice I say I. It's all about me, where I'm going to take them. And I never told them any of this. I never told them what I thought their potential was and what they were doing well and what they were doing, you know, what they could become or what I thought they could become. And I wasn't sharing with them the vision I had for the company or for me or for them or for anything. And my way to encourage them was to give them more work. Like, I thought that if you know, someone is doing real, so the people that weren't doing as well, I didn't give any work. But the people that were doing great, I would give more work to, but I wouldn't tell them they were doing a good job. I wouldn't tell them where I thought we were headed, and I didn't tell them that I had taken on the weight of their future. And so the big epiphany was that I need to acknowledge people for what it is they're good at doing. And just a simple, hey, checking in with you, what are you up to, how you doing? You're doing great, you know, this is fantastic. And then sharing the vision with them and learning that if you share the vision with people, they'll follow you. If you don't, they may or may not. And so this concept of just simply acknowledging people, recognizing them, because what I was doing, what they didn't know is I'm spending like most of my waking hours obsessing about them and their future and their future success. And all I have to do is let go of all of that, let them craft their own future and just acknowledge, hey, you know, you're, that was pretty sweet what you just did there. That's a good job. I really appreciate that. Hey, would you like to do this with me next? And not take on the weight of that. And so people is my biggest challenge, always will be. And I hope that's, you know, by the time I'm 70 years old, I actually know how to lead, you know.
Yeah.
And know how to get the most out of people, not for me, but for them.
I 100% resonates with me. You know, I've identified that it's a weak point of mine as well. And, you know, that is one of the reasons why I was open to getting a business coach like yourself. And, you know, just accepting that I don't know everything there is to know. You know, I went to school for business management. You would think that I have good people managing skills, but I think in reality, people are so dynamic that, like you said, like by the time you're 70, you might finally get it, but there's so much to learn. And, you know, my experience around other leaders is a lot of times they kind of fall into position. You know, they didn't go to school to become a leader. They didn't research or read books on how to be a leader. They just happened to be in the position of power or started a company. And to me, what separates the good leaders from the bad leaders, the good leaders know that they don't know nearly anything about leading. And then the bad leaders think they know everything and they're just boom, 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 boom. So
in general, it doesn't matter how much money someone has, how much success they've had, nobody knows what they're doing, right? Nobody has a clue. You know, it doesn't matter how, now your business may be more mature and so they know more than you know, but they still don't know where they're at because they've never been where they are. You know, same thing with you, with me. You know, I've never been to where I'm at now, so I don't know what to do. The only thing I can do is to hopefully, like I said, acknowledge some people for work well done, and hope that they don't all take me out. You know, both people watching me, people in my family, and you know, the close to me in life. You just hope that you can, you can wake up and it all just keeps moving forward. That's the goal, you know.
Yeah. Well, like I said, man, I feel like there's so many different tangents and paths we can go down to. So I look forward to reading some of the comments, of seeing what people would want to see us dive down next, and maybe we'll plan to do a podcast in a few months or something and circle back. But
where is this podcast? Is it just a playlist on the channel, or did you make a separate channel for it?
Yep. So there's a separate channel. It's the Scenic Route Podcast. And then it is also on Spotify and Apple Music or Apple Podcasts. So you can find it on all three. But yeah, you still got to listen to some of them. I want to see what you think as well.
Yeah, I haven't listened to it. I normally watch all the videos you make, so.
Yeah, it's on my little side channel. It's my side hustle.
Cool. Yeah, I'd love to come on and tell the whole story. We can keep going. You know me, I can talk. Weird, because I don't, just like you, we really don't talk that much in real life, you know. No. What I'm saying, you know, everybody thinks Adam is this crazy outgoing, you know, extrovert. It's nonsense. You guys probably don't know this, but like Adam will not vlog if anybody's around that he doesn't know.
And then they think that I'm being mean because I'm hiding behind the trailer, but they don't know that I'm just like shy as fuck, dude.
It's true.
Yeah.
All right, people.
All right, well.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to go. Yeah, of course. I'm going to go eat dinner with my dad. I appreciate you. Maybe next time we'll meet up in person as well. And, you know, we can look each other in the eyes while we.
I would give anything to drive out there. I'd be out there every other week. Soon.
Yeah, well, I'll come out to you.
All right. See ya.
Well, thank you, Matt. You guys can find Matt's channels in the description, links, all that stuff, websites. And we appreciate you, Matt. And we'll see you soon.
Yep. Later.
Cool. Thank you, guys. When you said